This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It might actually be because the new variant that is coming in, the body has actually not been stimulated to that immune response, and therefore you would get a reinfection.
That was Kolika Milesana, a microbiologist at South Africa's National Health Laboratory Service, on the possibility that a new variant of COVID-19 might be causing reinfections. Details coming up also. Ugandan soldiers withdraw from opposition presidential challenger Bobi Wine's home. And the departing U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia described the government's military operation in November in the Tigray region as legitimate self-defense. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Egypt's 2011 uprising raised hopes of a shift towards democracy, but experts say the country is sliding even further towards authoritarian rule. Tens of thousands of citizens are languishing in overcrowded prisons. Freedom of expression, media independence, and the opposition movements are curbed in the name of state stability. Parliament approved sweeping constitutional amendments to allow President Sisi's extension of power by expanding the role of the army as a state supervisory body and giving him the constitutional right to appoint judges and the prosecutor general. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed with Amy Hawthorne, Deputy Director of Research at Project for Democracy in the Middle East, how Egypt could move towards real democracy and what role, if any, the Biden administration could play.
In general, democratic change can be more lasting and more genuine when it comes gradually through gradual but real, genuine democratic change rather than through a sudden uprising or a regime collapse or a revolution that is so abrupt and tumultuous and brings in its wake a lot of turbulence and sometimes even chaos. Gradual but real democratic change that's carried out with pressure from below, from the citizenry, and engagement of the citizens, and also is led and implemented by people in the political elite. That is the ideal way to achieve genuine democratic change. I fear, though, that that kind of gradual reform, gradual democratization, step by step, is not on the table in Egypt, because the more repressive and ruthless and exclusionary the current regime of Abdel Fattah Sisi becomes in Egypt, the fewer opportunities there will be for any kind of gradual reform. And at some point, I fear that we will see another political explosion in Egypt from below, with citizens frustrated that their government and the rulers won't implement any kind of meaningful steps toward democracy, no matter how modest initially, and that the only recourse, or that Egyptians may feel their only recourse, is to push for dramatic upheaval and a change of regime with all the uncertainty and instability that that brings. So I believe that had the Mubarak regime more than 10 years ago actually put some gradual democratization measures in place, Egypt, instead of refusing to actually implement any and basically trying to cling to power, Egypt would be much, much better off today. And I worry, as I said, that another upheaval in Egypt is coming as a backlash to the complete lack of freedom and citizen participation that Egyptians suffer under today, and that that new coming upheaval will be much darker and much uglier than what we saw in Egypt a decade ago.
Do you expect any role for the Biden administration in promoting democracy and the human rights in Egypt?
We'll see. Several of the top foreign policy officials in the new Biden administration have spoken in general terms about the importance of the U.S. standing up for democracy and human rights all around the world. But where I really haven't seen many specifics is with regard to a country like Egypt, where on the one hand, there is very little at this time evident indigenous movement, indigenous demand toward democratic change. So it might be difficult for U.S. officials to see much to support on the ground in Egypt. And also, of course, Egypt remains an authoritarian U.S. security partner in the Arab world. And the U.S., as we know, historically has been very reluctant to push against authoritarian Arab allies who are partners on counterterrorism and security. I'm hopeful, though, that the new administration may handle this issue a bit better in Egypt than did the previous administration, because the human rights situation in Egypt is so terrible. The United States government is, in effect, subsidizing the Egyptian regime, which is carrying out these abuses of its own people, you know, subsidizing through our military and economic and diplomatic support. And a number of the key officials who are serving in the Biden administration served in the Obama administration during the Arab Spring. And one would hope, these are, you know, highly intelligent, experienced people, that they've drawn some lessons from how the U.S. responded 10 years ago and how the U.S. might handle these issues differently in the future. So I guess I would say I'm cautiously and modestly optimistic that the new U.S. administration will give more sustained attention to issues of human rights and democratic reform in Egypt.
That was Amy Hawthorne, Deputy Director of Research at Project for Democracy in the Middle East, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Nigerians are hopeful after U.S. President Joe Biden, in one of his first acts in office, reversed the travel restrictions imposed by former President Donald Trump on several predominantly Muslim and African nations. Nigeria was among the countries affected by the restrictions which the Trump administration imposed in 2017, citing security threats, but which critics saw as discriminatory. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Abuja resident Joseph Abba wished to honeymoon with his wife in the United States after their wedding in 2018. He readied their documents and applied for a visa, but says his visa was denied even though he met the basic requirements.
As an applicant, the pain of being refused, even when you know you're qualified, is something else. So knowing the already concluded decisions even before going for interview. So it's a total discouragement on the applicant.
Nigeria was one of several African nations included in the travel bans imposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump. As a result, travel between Nigeria and the U.S. became almost impossible. The Trump administration said the restrictions were imposed because of terrorism concerns, saying the countries on the list did not meet minimum security standards. But critics like Abba doubt security reasons were the real reason.
Nigeria is not the only country in the world that is having insecurity as a problem. Security is just like a pandemic. It's a global problem.
President Trump was highly criticized in his early days in office for derogatory comments about African countries. On his first day in office, Trump's successor, Joe Biden, signed 17 executive orders, including one that overturned the travel restrictions. Nigerian business owners like Taiwo Charles, who runs a travel agency in Abuja, welcomed the move.
It's going to be a big relief for entrepreneurs like me, especially in the travel industry, who can now begin to see so many opportunities coming up, and then we begin to enjoy the benefit of inflows between Nigeria and America.
With travel made easier once again, Nigerians like Abba say they will begin to visit the United States again, and travel companies are expecting to see a rise in revenue. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
As South Africa prepares to receive its first batch of 1 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine, Authorities worry that growing myths may scare citizens into refusing to be inoculated. Experts have dismissed the myths as fake news, and the government is vowing to embark on a campaign to dispel them. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The Department of Health is adamant that the first batch of vaccine will be in South Africa by the end of the month and ready for rollout. Zweli Mkhize is the Minister of Health.
We're still on course because the issue was to target January. We haven't got any reason to worry about that change. So as soon as the vaccines come, we will then start a vaccination program in February, anticipating 1 million vials, and then next month we'll be expecting another 500,000.
However, the news has been met by myths. Some say the vaccine is the biblical mark of the beast and a ploy by the devil to capture citizens. Others allege it is a product of 5G technology, allegedly aimed to depopulate the world. Some claim it has the potential to change people's DNA, and still others have described it as an injection of death. As a result, some like Thandeka Phakathi want nothing to do with the vaccine.
Personally, I will not be taking the vaccine because of the myths around the whole thing. Currently, there are rumors that people are dying after taking the vaccine, and there are other rumors saying that there will be chips inserted in our systems. So at the current moment, I will not be taking the vaccine unless it has been run through the members of the parliament first.
Others like Bongani Mabasa are rejecting the myths.
I don't believe if you take the vaccine you have side effects or you start to be sick or you'll be eliminated. I do not believe that. And it's something that I'll never believe. I don't believe that our government will use something as a vaccine to eliminate its people.
Shabri Madi, professor of vaccinology at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, attributes the myth to lack of knowledge.
COVID-19 is going to be with us for decades still. What vaccines are able to do is hopefully they're able to actually prevent the type of resurgences that we're experiencing. Immediately, in the immediate future, trying to protect people from dying from COVID, and then in a more medium term, to try to prevent this type of resurgences by having a large enough percentage of the population that eventually develop immunity.
President Cyril Ramaphosa says the government is worried by these myths.
We need to build broad acceptance amongst our people of the vaccine program and to vigorously tackle misinformation and misunderstanding, ensuring that we speak accurately, basing our pronouncements on facts, on science and medical evidence.
Under the government rollout plan, health workers will be the first to get the vaccine, followed by essential workers, the elderly, and those with pre-existing health conditions. The rest of the population will come last. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Scientists have already established the variant of COVID-19 identified in South Africa last month is more infectious and thus more transmissible than the original coronavirus. Now they're trying to find out the variant called 501YV2 is causing more people to be reinfected. COVID-19 has so far claimed the lives of more than 41,000 people and infected about 1.4 million in South Africa. Darren Taylor has more.
Researchers have shown that the variant helps the virus to escape from antibodies. But Kuleka Mlisana, a microbiologist at South Africa's National Health Laboratory Service, or NHLS, wants to know much more about 501Y.V2. She and her team of scientists have been studying it since its existence was confirmed.
So we then had to look to see, are we seeing reinfections in the country in the first place, and then relate that to the variant. Now that we have got this variant, are the reinfections a lot more than we had been seeing during the course of the pandemic?
Mlisana explains that most people who get COVID-19 mount an immune response that usually is strong enough to prevent them from being infected a second time. But, she adds, the variant is complicating things.
It might actually be because the new variant that is coming in, the body has actually not been stimulated to that immune response, and therefore you would get a reinfection.
Her team first had to establish the extent of COVID-19 reinfections in the country using data collected from all tests done for the virus at the NHLS since the pandemic began in the country in March last year.
When we were at the 6th of January, we had actually done more than 6.7 million tests and we had 150,000 cases. And we therefore analyzed to see, are there any individuals who had a positive test and then a second positive test 90 days or more later? As of the 6th of January, with this, you know, analysis, we had more than 4,000 potential reinfections, which therefore says to us we are getting reinfections.
But, says the scientist, it's too early to say what's driving the reinfections and which groups of people are susceptible to getting COVID-19 a second time. Mlisana says she and her colleagues have seen enough reinfections to make a preliminary finding.
So far, we are able to say there is no evidence that suggests that the risk of reinfections is increasing as a result of the new variant. But bear in mind, we are only talking a month so far. We are going to continue to monitor this data and to look to see whether there's any change. If right now...
Her team's going to isolate cases of reinfection to see if reinfected patients have more serious clinical symptoms the second time round, and to try to determine if they're linked to the new variant.
By doing this research, we're going to be able to actually gain more knowledge and we'll be able to interpret this variant and the impact that it has on the reinfections a lot better.
Mlisana says COVID-19 is cleverer than anticipated, and it may well turn out that a second, as yet unidentified variant is responsible for new cases and even reinfections in South Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The departing U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia, Michael Raynor, called for full access to the country's Tigray region for Ethiopian and international aid organizations. In a farewell news conference yesterday, Raynor also called for an independent investigation of all credible reports of atrocities, sexual violence, and human rights violations in Tigray and places like Metekel in the Amhara region. However, Raynor described the federal government's military operation in Tigray region as legitimate self-defense.
We have been clear from the outset that we did not see and do not see equivalence between the two sides. One is the federal state with an obligation for territorial integrity and the safety of its people. The other was an armed insurrection, illegitimate and really unfortunate. I really wish that that had not been launched. I do say that the government's military response, I know, sought to be proportionate to the challenge and sought to wrap up as quickly as it could. But there's never a clean aftermath to war. It always has a messy aftermath, and unfortunately that's the moment we're in, and that's where our focus is as the United States right now, in particular making sure people's rights and safety are respected, making sure that their humanitarian needs are met, making sure this doesn't become more of a regional issue than it already has, and to pull back where that has already been the case. It's prompted, as I said, Eritrean engagement that we're concerned by. It's exacerbated border tensions, both internally between Amhara and Tigray, and externally between Ethiopia and Sudan.
Raynor also discussed U.S. concerns about the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, or GERD, which Sudan and Egypt fear will cut water flow on the Nile. In September, the U.S. suspended much of its aid to Ethiopia after talks with Sudan and Egypt about filling the dam failed to make progress.
Nothing is unprecedented here. There are many dams in the world on rivers that cut across national boundaries, and those countries have succeeded in coming up with mutually acceptable agreements on how to operate those dams. That's all we hope to see in this regard, and we encourage all three parties to participate in that. I will say that Ethiopia has built the dam. It's a marvelous feat of engineering. I had the opportunity to visit the dam during my time here. But as the builder of the dam, it's my view that Ethiopia bears an additional burden to facilitate a harmonious agreement on the operation of it, and to take steps that will boost the confidence of the downstream countries in Ethiopia's responsible engagement on that issue. We wish it had done more, and we believe it can do more in that regard. Unilaterally filling the dam against the objections of the downstream countries was a provocative step. It did not build the confidence necessary to reach an agreement. Announcements that it will operate the dam with or without an agreement have a similar effect. So that's the concern we have specifically with regards to Ethiopia, is that it has an additional role to play in building confidence, and we just hope that it will look for ways to inspire the trust and confidence necessary to reach an agreement. The freeze on foreign assistance was a specific reaction to the first fill decision, which we thought was particularly unhelpful in trying to foster an agreement.
Raynor went on to say that he viewed the suspended aid delivery as a lost opportunity for both the United States and Ethiopia. He said the new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has signaled strong interest in its relationship with Ethiopia, and Raynor said he hoped it would look at the issue of the dam and the aid. Asked if the U.S. wants to counter China's growing presence in Ethiopia and other African countries, Raynor said the goal is to build partnerships.
We don't want to counter a country's influence. We don't want to counter a region's influence. We want to counter malign influence. And we think the best way to do that is to set an example of positive influence, partnership that is true and respectful and impactful, finding areas of shared interest and using that as the basis for partnership. We are concerned when some actors do things that cause a country to incur billions of dollars in debt. You know, if you look at Ethiopia's economics, the price of servicing such debts is very debilitating to its own development priorities. The United States brings over $1 billion a year here, roughly even between development and humanitarian support, from which exactly $0 of the debt is incurred. We think that's a model of partnership and respect. And that's what we want to embody in how we do business.
The career diplomat said that during his 3 years as ambassador, the U.S. has contributed $3 billion in aid for education, economic development, and humanitarian programs in Ethiopia. Raynor also said the U.S. would support Ethiopia's planned elections later this year. An attorney for opposition presidential challenger Bobby Wine says Ugandan soldiers have withdrawn from his home a day after a judge ruled that the house arrest was unlawful. Press reports also indicate that foreign pressure from the United States, rights groups Amnesty International, and others has been growing on President Yoweri Museveni to remove the restrictions. Ugandan authorities have said he can only leave his home under military escort because they fear his presence could incite rioting. Bobby Wine, a politician musician whose real name is Robert Chagulani, is an idol to many who say Museveni is out of touch. Museveni casts Wine as a foreign puppet and a troublemaker. According to the Associated Press, security forces can still be seen in the village near Bobby Wine's property outside the capital, Kampala. Museveni was declared the winner of the election with 58% of the vote to 34% for Bobby Wine, who insists he was cheated out of victory. The government denies any irregularities. A Kenyan citizen was flown to the U.S. yesterday after being extradited on charges of conspiracy to traffic in rhinoceros horns and elephant ivory. U.S. Attorney Audrey Strauss for the Southern District of New York said Mansour Muhammad Surur, aka Mansour, was arrested by Kenyan authorities on July 29th for illegally poaching more than 35 rhinoceros and more than 100 elephants. In addition, Soror also was charged with conspiracy to commit money laundering and conspiracy to distribute and possess with intent to distribute more than 10 kilograms of heroin. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yaparo, thank you again for tuning in.